Hello, Comics Inebriated listeners. My name is Don Cardenas, and no, don't worry. I'm not another fill-in host for Matt. I'm just here to spread the word about my podcast, Comics, Coffee, Metal, where along with recommendations of those glorious topics, I interview creatives involved in and around the worlds of, well, comics, coffee, and metal. We've been honored to have some great shows with guests such as Michael Conrad and Noah Bailey, Kelly Williams, Shadia Amin, Sophie Campbell, Sean Pryor, and of course, everyone's favorite comics uncle, Liana Kangas. You can find the show by searching Comics Coffee Metal on any of the major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, and Spotify. Thank you for your time, and now back to yours and my favorite podcast, Comics Inebriated.
Comics Inebriated, a podcast about the history of fiction and nonfiction in comics, along with current events, hosted by comic creators Liana Kangas and permanent guest Matt Emmons.
Welcome back to Comics Inebriated. I am Liana, your co-host that is probably the most reliable one at this point. I'm just saying, and I'm joined by...
Your least reliable. I've never established myself as reliable, Matt Emmons.
That's true.
Unreliable. And we're joined by another guest who's going to take the spotlight off of me now.
Yeah. We're joined by Joe Glass. How are you?
Hi there. It's so lovely to finally have another drink with you after so long.
It's been so many years. We have been robbed of our, our honestly, like, clubbing kind of vibe, but yeah. We'll get to that later. But yeah, you're here to talk about something.
I'm here to talk about Marvel's Generation X, a little bit specifically volume one, I guess it's called now, because like that's the one which I know more about and which I absolutely love and adore. Volume, not what I'm saying, but I didn't love and adore volume two. Volume two.
No, you said it. It's fine.
It was great, but it wasn't the characters I fell in love with, you know? So yeah, for me, I'm very much talking about Generation X when you guys are ready for me.
I will say, before I let you get started, we have had so many people reach out to talk about any X topics, period.
Always said no.
And we've always kind of reserved, just because it wasn't specific enough. Just because talking about blanket X-Men, we could turn into an entire podcast, which podcasts do exist about that.
We don't want to do a 12-hour episode.
We're really appreciative that you chose, Generation X. And yeah, feel free to take it away.
Yeah, cool. So Gen X came out September 1994. It's listed on covers in November 1994. I guess that's some sort of like publishing convention, but that's one of those publishing things I just don't understand, like why 2 months ahead. I don't know. But it came out in September 1994, which is actually the month of my birth. And
directly
became
related.
The first I loved comic books by this point. Like I'd read a few comic books, but like this was the comic book series which I became addicted to. And like the first which I actually like collected.
That's incredible. Do you still have them?
Sorry?
You still have them?
A bunch of them, yeah. Like it's the weird thing with Gen X. Gen X is really hard to come by. Like back when it was coming out in the mid 90s, American comics weren't easy to get here in the UK, but like they were comic shops, but they were still sort of mainly in major city centers. You didn't find many sort of spread out. So where I was growing up, there was like no comic shops. The nearest one was like an hour or so away. So I would just get them when I could get my hands on them, or I would be reading it mainly via a UK reprint called, I want to say it's called Amazing X-Men, which would have like an X-Men story and a Gen X issue in one comic. And that's kind of how I started. And then I went out and collected the issues. And the weird thing is as well, Gen X has never really been collected much. It's only ever been collected in Generation X Volume 1, which has come out I think like 5 times at this point. It's ridiculous. So that always contains identical. It's ridiculous. With 5 identical versions, you know, they more or less.
And no cover update or anything.
If I could do that.
The cover's nearly always the same cover. They might just chuck in a little snazzy board around
it. It's like the Skyrim thing of just re-releasing. If I could get away with re-releasing the same work like every year for 10
decades,
I would have hundreds of them.
What a joy that would be.
You know, it's wild to me. And like, it's really wild because Gen X had a lot of really good stories in it, but, and this is part of why I love it and part of why I'll get to it a bit, is it has a lot of duff stories in it as well. It's not a series which ever really has a middling ground. It's either really good or really bad, and it never had a middle stage.
You stay for the bad because the good.
Oh yeah, I would
good.
Like stick through the bad, and it was like it didn't matter. I would hang around because I know it can be good, and then yeah, it would go up and down. So yeah, it started like say 1994, mm-hmm. and the whole idea premise of it was there's going to be a whole new group of teenage X-Men, because obviously that's regularly kind of been a thing in the history of X-Men. Like yeah. X-Men started off and they're teenage characters. And then, obviously, they got older, and they started getting married and stuff, so they had to bring new ones in, so they did the New Mutants. And then we got to the 90s, and, like, counterculture movement and the Generation X sort of generation was a thing. And they finally were like, you know what, let's do a new teen series. So they had this event called Phalanx Covenant, where the X-Men are all being kidnapped by this race of techno-organic beings who are like a liquid version of Star Trek's for Borg, and they want to capture them all, and they've captured the Generation X kids that Xavier had secret files on. And it's a bit of a long story, to quote another really popular podcast about X-Men things, like, don't worry about it.
I was gonna say, sounds like a Marvel storyline. Yeah,
oh totally, it absolutely was. But like, this then spun off into the Generation X book proper. And it just introduced this very different style of teen superhero characters. And it's why I immediately fell in love with it. Now, like I say, it came out in 1994. So for me, I was 10 years old. Or was turning 10 years old, I guess. So it was a specific point in my life where I was at that stage where teenageness was coming into my very near future. And
cool, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. Like teen cool, and like suddenly I'm thinking like, oh, I want to be one of those cool edgy teens and stuff like that. It's very much back to where my kid space was. But I was also very patently aware that I was different, in the sense of like I was becoming very aware of my queerness, even if I didn't necessarily know how to verbalize that, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. That makes sense.
So Gen X was very quickly became a very important thing for me, you know? So I was obsessed with this book. You have these teens who were like this disaffected group of teenagers, not the usual teen superheroes who are bright and peppy. They were like, these were kids who like hated what they were going through. And some of them with good reason. Like you had characters like Skin, who literally has 6 extra feet of epidermis, which he can like flick out like stretchy, like Mr. Fantastic, it's somehow grosser. And his face almost looks like it's melting in the first issue.
That's so what I've always like loved about the X-Men mutants is not all of them got a good power. A lot of them have a pretty bunk deal. Yeah.
Yes, and here's what you think. They're not all hot. They have one character in Gen X who should not have been hot, yet to my prepubescent mind was strangely hot.
X-Men
there
is
was a
literally
character called Chamber, Jonathan Starsmore.
I'm gonna tell you if Chamber's hot or not.
His face and his chest literally get blown out by an explosion of like psionic fire. So he's literally missing his lower jaw and chest. He spends most of the time wrapped up in bandages, but he's dressed in a leather jacket. He's got long brown hair. He's really broody. Preteen Joe was already in it.
You're right.
We love a good damaged, hot, moody, damaged boy.
Exactly.
It's the all wrapped. You don't see their face. You're like, that's kind of
You know, and it was just at a time where, like, broody, dark guy was exactly what everyone wanted.
Because you were looking to your teen future.
No, you're right. Yeah. You were right to think so then and now. Yeah.
So, like, it's this weird thing. You have these characters who had quite often, like, not shitty powers, but, like, powers which were quite shitty for them. Like, even, like, yes, the ones who were ostensibly, oh, they seem like they're okay. You get, like, Husk, who's this really pretty southern blonde woman who can tear off all of her skin.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Why which not? Is just like, yeah, it's okay.
It's something to do. Superhero you know? Name for that.
You know? So, yeah, you had all these characters who were, like, really awesome. And that's when the series is at its best. And you know, I would be remiss not to mention that, unfortunately, the series, which I absolutely love, was occasionally and quite often handled by people who are problematic at best. So, like, it was initially written by Scott Lodell, and the art was by Chris Bacalow. And this was Chris Bacalow, not problematic at all, lovely, lovely artist guy. And this was at this really interesting stage in Bacalow's artistic path where his art was actually changing, and it changes through the series.
Always so cool to see.
It's so awesome because, like, Bacalow had this really photorealistic, isn't right, but like it was very sort of realism aspect to it, you know? Mm-hmm. And then he starts changing into a much more streamlined cartoonish kind of style, which is nonetheless absolutely packed with like extra stuff in the background. Like his comics nearly always have like frogs dancing around in the background for no apparent reason and stuff like that. And it's just like, this was filmed. So like the issues regularly looked amazing. And the stories were actually really good because they, at the time, sounded kind of like teenagers, you know, or at least what we imagine teenagers sound like when you're a preteen kid who like thinks teenagers.
And back then, like for us, like exactly. pre-cell phones, pre all that business.
Exactly. So it was like, it was this awesome idea of teens for me. And like, also obviously it was presenting like a school for weird kids who were different from everyone else, and I'm just like, yeah, okay, I'm already hooked on this. Like, I already have the X-Men cartoon. I'm like already in on this.
Yeah,
it's for you.
And like, I think the issue which finally cemented it for me was, I think it was like issue 4 or 5, I think. And basically, there was this big storyline happening in across all the X-Men books at the time. Called the Legacy Virus, whereby like a villain had introduced this virus into Earth's atmosphere, which ostensibly only affects mutants. And it was a heavy-handed allegory for HIV/AIDS.
Yeah, okay. This is one thing I know about.
Oh yeah. It was like, and like when I say like heavy-handed, it was at times really heavy-handed. At times it was handled quite well. And a part of me at that time appreciated it. And here's the storyline which really sort of like the issue which really cemented it for me was this particular issue has a moment where Husk learns about the Legacy Virus for the first time. Like a story breaks on the news and it's like the first time the world becomes aware. And it's sort of through like dialogue captions, because this is still at the time where comic books had the narrative device of an omniscient narrator. Which so few comic books use now. But like at that time was like everywhere. Every comic had an omniscient narrator, you know? And Gen X still had it. And through those captions, like the narrator's talking about how, you know, she's worked all this all her life to be like the best possible X-Man, to be a hero like her brother, to really work really hard and all this. Even for a world that fears and hates her, which she's just about accepted and everything, only to then discover that there's this virus out there and in all likelihood, there's a good chance it'll just kill her. And at that time, I don't know what it was like over there with you guys, and obviously you guys are probably too young to even remember it, but at that time here in the UK, the HIV/AIDS crisis had sort of run rampant through the 80s. And even in the early 90s, like it was still very much heavily on people's minds, even to the point that children, so like I said, I was 10. I was 10, maybe going on to 11. And even at that time, and not really fully understand that I was a gay man and all this, but having an inkling, it was prevalent to the point that even if I couldn't write an essay on it at the time, I knew it was there. Like, I knew it was out there, and it was a very, it created an anxiety, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
just like we had, I don't know if you guys had it, we had like this advert here, or commercial, which was like for everyone's safety, which was literally just a black screen with smoke billowing through, and then a giant tombstone, which just had like HIV AIDS written on it.
Jesus Christ.
Just fell down. And he just talked about how, like, if you know, you got to wear a condom, my boy, so you're going to get AIDS and you're going to die. And we didn't necessarily like, it was out there like, in all times of day.
We might have had like commercial advertisements and stuff like that, but my mom was like pretty prevalent in the gay community. Mm. And you'd see like a lot of prejudices and stuff like that, like just mostly like in our communities, that like me growing up and watching like you know, drag queens and stuff like that, like see the type of like social flack that they got outside of like safe spaces like bars and clubs where they perform. So like as and especially like growing up in Florida, like people like you'd think that people wouldn't even walk around someone who was gay. You know what I mean? Like, that's exactly how bad it was still in, you know, the 90s and like, stuff for us.
There's so many stories, like, here in the UK. Like, if you looked at the UK press, I mean, we talk about the UK press now and how they treat Meghan Markle and how, like, it's incredibly racist and they literally treat her like dirt. That they did that to the gay community in the 80s and early 90s. Like, it was disgusting.
Unfortunately, not the articles surprised. Were being
written. Yeah. So like it was everywhere, you know, it was this prevalent, like all around you all the time, 24/7. So if you were a kid who had any kind of inkling in your body that, you know, I think I kind of like someone of the same sex or something like that, you were aware of this, whether you wanted to be or not. So
yeah,
the fact that this comic was a superhero book, but it dealt with things like that. Mm-hmm. I love that. And that was when Gen X was at its best. When it would deal with things like that and deal with the sort of the actual concerns which modern teenagers were having. And I don't mean in sort of like concerns about like, oh no, that supervillain's going to destroy the academy or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean like actual concerns like, oh, there's this omnipresent virus out there just creating this air of anxiety, which I'm really terrified about and stuff like that. And these were like real things which real kids were dealing with. And I loved it for that. Like, and it really hooked its way into my heart and soul. And I always now credit it as this was the book which made me want to make comic books. Like, this was what made me think I want to tell superhero stories and the kind of superhero stories I want to tell.
Is it mostly because you wanted to, like, swap the narrative to, like, mm-hmm. educate people? Or just because, like...
It's, like, I'm almost... wary of saying educate people, because that immediately creates in people's mind's eye like the idea of me on a soapbox, and no one likes anyone on a soapbox yelling things at you, which you don't like.
I hear people are going street and stuff, perhaps. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But like I want to present a different point of view. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I want to do in my comics, and also give the chance for certain people and particularly certain communities to get the chance to see themselves be the hero, which mainstream comics or mainstream superhero comics in particular weren't doing. And if you ask me, still aren't doing, really, but you know, or at least not well enough to my happiness, but there you go. I'm sure we'll be getting into that later.
That's a whole different series. That's a whole different
podcast. Oh, that was a whole other podcast. I mean, if you wanted to talk about LGBTQ in comics, we would have been here all night. So like, it's a good thing I didn't pick that, because that was definitely too broad.
That's a couple bottles worth of drinking.
Yeah.
Oh, easily. You would never shut me up.
That would be one of the ones that we have to do in person. Like.
Mm. Oh God, definitely. But so the series keeps going. Now, like I said, that's the series when it's at its best. Almost immediately following that kind of plot line, and like the team coming together and all that, you had a plot line where they go to Ireland to Banshee, who's one of the teachers, home castle, because everyone in Ireland has a castle.
That's the one thing I know.
Where you find out that he was also an Interpol agent who was fighting a pre-tentacled Omega Red and all this. And the team gets transported to the land of Fae to reignite a furnace which is bringing magic to the land of Fae. So
yeah, this is all stuff I just assumed, you know.
Yeah, you know, this was that kind of stuff where like I would read those issues and I would gloss over. I would like, we've gone from like, oh, this is amazing, this is amazing, this is amazing, to what is happening right now. So
you can swear on the you can,
fever dream.
You're allowed. Good thing, yeah. I should have checked that beforehand.
I love when people ask, so I'm glad to point it out anytime.
So yeah, it was wild to me. You would get these complete up and downs, and there was never anything in the middle. It was either this really kind of not po-faced but kind of honest teen story drama. High drama because it's superheroes and explosions, right, and whatnot. But superheroes like,
and teens, so
you know,
stressful on teens, yeah.
Or it would be absolute low troughs of the most bizarre and weird asides, which nowadays as a writer I look back and I'm just like, what on earth possessed them? And it
maybe
just
it was
did
deadlines.
That, you know,
maybe it was deadlines, maybe it was paychecks. I don't know. They're like, I gotta get like I have to write 6 issues. Oh boy, time to make
Maybe they're born with it. Maybe it's deadlines.
A castle. Yeah. I don't know.
And it just felt like that. It just kind of goes like that. And it was weird because the original writers, original creators, Scott Lodell and Chris Baglow leave fairly early on. I think Lodell leaves earlier than Baglow, I think. Maybe about like an issue in the teens, like the late teens, I think. And then Baglow leaves around issue 25 or 30 or something. And then the book gets taken over and it doesn't really have a consistent voice again for a little while. And it's sort of mixed between Larry Hammer writing and Jay Faber, I think. Art goes a little bit all over as well because the artist just seems to change every issue until they finally settle on Terry and Rachel Dodson. And for a while, the series comes back to on like a very much an upward trajectory because the art is fantastic. The story, however, is wilding. It is absolutely wilding.
Now, is that good, bad, or neither?
I like it. It's terrible, but I liked it. I was obsessed, but okay. It was another what the fuck were they smoking moment. So before getting too far into Bat Rabbit Hole, there's a character in Generation X who is something of a weird history. She's the actual character of Generation X who probably did the best after the series finished. And that's Monet St. Croix, otherwise known as M. Now, M originally... Oh, and there's another character who's tangentially connected as well called Penance, who is introduced in the first issue of Generation X, who is this character who's, again, covered in bandages, but she's like got red skin, bright blue eyes, spiky hair, and like long spiky claw hands and things
just like me. Yeah,
yeah. And she's meant to be like diamond hard skin, razor sharp and everything, like she can't touch anyone because she'll tear them to ribbons, blah blah blah. Now originally the plan for the series was that Penance was going to be this mutant from Yugoslavia, which was war torn, and you know, meant to be back was part of her trauma. The other part of her trauma was she was also kidnapped by the main enemy of Generation X, which was this mutant vampire called M-Plate, who liked to stick for bone marrow of mutants and stuff. And she used to do that repeatedly to her, and she was tied to a chair. Don't worry about it.
We got to do a subsection of this episode where it's just you speed explaining.
I feel like we're going to have to need to credit CerebroCast because of the amount of times I'm just going to have to say, don't worry about it.
Speed it up a little bit. It'll be like side effects.
Absolutely.
Please listen to CerebroCast.
But,
yeah. So yeah, there's a lot of that happening, and you have Penance there, and then you have M. Now M was always going to have a slightly weird origin, in that M's going through these weird moments. Like she's meant to be perfect. Like she's got telepathy, she got flight, she got super strength. Good she's absolutely gorgeous, and she's just amazing. And like everyone, and Jubilee kind of hates her a little bit for it because it's just like, here's this girl who's absolutely amazing. But she also has these moments where she just seems to enter this fugue state and just is completely oblivious to everything going around her, or so it seems. The idea was that M was going to be revealed to be essentially two kids in a trench coat. Like, literally.
I love that so much.
The whole deal was M was not real. Monet was not real, rather. It's like Monet was, in fact, two little girls who had the, amongst the other mutant powers that M presents as, the mutant power to merge together into a teenage girl. And it then made sense why M was the way she was, because she was every little child's idea of what a perfect grown-up is, mm-hmm. which is obnoxious and full of themselves and kind of knows what thinks they know everything's everything they do is right and all this. So it made so much sense of why M was M. And like I say, Penis was otherwise unrelated. She was just the mutant vampire guy, M plate, would actually turn out to be the brother of M / the two kids. Mm-hmm. Now, that reveal did happen.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That reveal did happen. We did find out that M was, in fact, two kids in a trench coat pretending to be a teenager.
Were they also vampires?
No, they were not. Thankfully, okay. Thankfully, they were not vampires. They were normal. I say normal little kids.
What all kids do is combine to become one.
Exactly. Whole, like, arc and is the whole about a vampire thing was... with the whole...
Oh, that was like because he mucked around with magic or something. So that's how he became a vampire. It's weird.
Obviously.
And the whole thing with the fugue states for M was because that one of the little girls was autistic. So when she was entering those fugue states, it was basically the autistic child was taking the wheel, as it were, you know? Mm. And I think like the whole thing you meant to really get from it is that when she's entering these states, she's kind of observing everything to the point that she's observing too much. She's not actually partaking in what's happening anymore. She's just observing. Mm. But it meant that that's part of why she was really smart and could see through to the problem all the time. Anyway, they did do that reveal. But then the new writer came on and decided to make it weirder. Because that's exactly what you want to do. So they then reveal in this whole pan-dimensional epic, which I think goes on for like, if it wasn't 10 issues, it felt like 10 issues.
It was actually 22 pages.
You know? And it was just a long time of the kids getting separated, some of whom get sent on this steam engine train through interdimensional space to like the heart of the Omniverse or the
Polar Express, basically.
Yeah. It's they also are joined by Apuka, who has apparently been living in the Danger Grotto. They have a Danger Grotto instead of a Danger Room at the school.
Who?
Apuka is a Celtic mythology thing. It's usually a 6 foot tall animal of some kind.
Why wouldn't that be on a?
Yeah, in this case, it was a weasel. They're joined by Apuka, who is a 6 foot tall weasel.
Me too.
Who's drinking martinis, if I remember correctly, the whole time. And it's wild. It's obviously like the guys, right? You know, I can't remember if it's Jay Farber or Larry Hama. Had just seen Harvey. They were just like, I must include this. So you had that kind of going on, which was just, what the hell? And they decide that here's what we're going to do with M. M was for two kids in a trench coat, but there's also a real Monet. And Monet St. Croix is actually Penance, who was turned into Penance by their vampiric mutant brother, M Plate. And we're going to find this out by merging them all together into a singular entity called M Plate. And yeah, it was just wilding. Eventually, they all come out.
Does that make them an adult if it's a teenager and two kids?
Oh, yeah. They become like a weird adult who is like Monet, but with M Plate's hair and his toes and his just all, and his little mouse in his hands and all this. You know, and he wants to get to like, or they want to get to the very center of the multiverse or whatever, take control of it or something. I actually can't even remember what the actual plan was.
I'm surprised you remember this much, especially the weasel with the
journey.
Martinis.
It's the journey. It's never about the plan.
And then, they get pulled apart, and you then get the real Monet is now M. M Plate is back to being M Plate and doing his whole deal. And then the kids are now Penance. And then a few issues later, the kids come out of Penance, and yet Penance is still around. And that confuses everyone because, like, Penance shouldn't exist.
Penance is its own entity now.
Yeah, Penance becomes its own entity, and it's like a whole, and then they more or less vanish. Now, a lot of this has now since been kind of retconned a little bit, because now, obviously, since Jonathan Hickman took over, M can become Penance, and it's now part of her power set. And I'm like, okay, that's cool for streamlining it, because frankly, that was one of those things. It's almost as bad and as confusing to try and explain to a non-comics person as the Summer's Bloodline in X-Men comics.
I don't know what even that is.
Scott Summers, Cyclops, and his brother Alex, and then they've got another brother, and there might be another brother, and it's just like a whole.
Okay, deal. Yeah, this is a whole other thing.
Is this like a whole in thing. Like House of X or whatever?
Yes,
which
yes,
I have House purchased X, and 10. Still not read.
Oh, spoilers!
No, it's fine. Oh, if I'm living in society with so many people I call friends that love the X-Men this much, there's absolutely no way I can go anywhere.
Oh, I was going to say, by this point,
it's fine. For you. I'd rather it spoiled for me at this point, honestly. Like, gives me less reading to do.
So that was, I got to admit, that was around the time where I kind of dropped off. I went to university by this point. And where I went to university, it was even harder to get comics. And like I say, the easier thing to get was trade paperbacks. And like I say, Gen X was never really collected in trade paperbacks. So that for the longest time was like the end of my reading experience of Gen X. And then it sort of came back to it really late. I think they ended around issue 75. And that came out around the time where Grant Morrison came on and took over X-Men. And Joe Quesada was editor-in-chief of Marvel at the time, I believe. And he came down with the whole deal that, you know what, there's too many mutants. He didn't like that there were so many mutants in the Marvel Universe or something. So, like, they wanted to streamline things. And, like, Grant Morrison was already going to have a bunch of new students in the X-Mansion. So Gen X got cancelled. It's very possible the sales was also a big part of that as well, because certainly the sales had declined in that latter stage of Gen X's publication run. But I think that, without having looked at the figures again, but I think it was doing well enough that now it would probably still go by our current ideas of like what kind of numbers you need to do. Mm-hmm. They cancelled it because like they were obviously streamlining the whole mutant side of Marvel.
Yeah.
So that was the end of Gen X. This, and like I say, it ended on a pretty, not sour note, but a very dark note, because during this whole like period, which I'd missed, and I actually then had to like catch up on, and it's still something I do, because like I say, it's never been collected. So when I do Comic Cons and stuff, I'll often go looking through the comic racks and the bins, and I look for like back.
Yeah, you never know if you're going to find what you're looking for.
Exactly. It means like there's this one series I will always collect and try and get every issue of. Mm-hmm. And I'm most of the way through it. But but towards the end, they got taken over again by Warren Ellis, who did the overarching plot.
I hope you can all hear our eye rolls.
Oh, yeah. Overarching plot to then be scripted by Brian Wood. So yeah, like I say, Gen X does have a bit of trouble, unfortunately.
Trouble.
And that sort of last two arcs really were really kind of dark for the series, and I think it was kind of the nail in the coffin for me, Gen X. It had lost any sense of fun it had, and while it brought it back to an idea of a slightly more realistic problems that teens face kind of thing, it was being a little too po-faced about it and a little too grim about it all. So it just kind of made the whole series feel like not fun to read anymore. So that was when Island Coffin and Gen X ended. Unfortunately, then the Gen X kids also then become the punching bag for Marvel and seem to have the worst plot lines happen to them for years after the series finishes, to a point where it's only really now starting to get better. Like Chambers appeared in a few books and he's, you know, back to normal. Well, I say normal, glowing face.
Yeah, normal problems. But
normal for Chamber, you know, and getting some fun things to do. And people seem to be really respecting, but he's a really awesome design and stuff again now. Jubilee has her firework powers back, and it's the important part of like
the character. Love a Jubilee. Yeah,
I think I know Jubilee.
M keeps on going from strength to strength. And
I was going to say... Characters... Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, we should take a moment to pour one out.
Oh, yeah, pour one out that we lost. Refill one for all X-Men lost.
Because, honestly, that was the thing with Gen X. So many of those Gen X kids got the crappy plot lines or got killed. So, like, Sink died in one of the final arcs of Gen X.
And we're back. After we had a 2-hour memoriam for all the X-Men that died. I couldn't name a single one, but we're back.
I only know Husk at this point.
Husk died?
Husk didn't die. Husk survived. However, she got totally crappy plot lines for like years and years.
Someday, the Raycon stuff. I just
she doesn't die. She has sex with Angel, who's like a good 12 years older, in the sky in front of her mother.
Not gross at all.
No. Yeah. Who's writing that? And who's like, time to pay you for that?
You know, it was like the weirdest, grossest thing. And it was just like, what the hell is going on?
Why and did then, I like, pick the later, worst she... character?
Nah, yeah. I'll say, every time I worry about if I'm like not a great writer, I'm like, I'm not doing that. I think that's good for me. So I'm,
I mean, this
I'm
is never the same guy who decided to make it canon, but Nightcrawler has two penises. So...
What? That's a thing about him?
It's technically canon, but like, or at least it's a kind of implied or something, but like, he's got...
I don't want to talk about that at all. I mean, that's his problem. That's a
I
whole
just
plot.
Want Jean
that's
and an Cyclops and
I just want Jean out about ugly green dress.
Yes, well, I just want that throuple to happen, you know?
Yes, just that whole polyamory thing needs to be absolute canon. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say how it cannot be canon at this point, but yeah, when you've got the two bedrooms which connect and everything, it's just like, okay, you know?
I learn something new every day. Well, speaking of comics, though...
Yeah, I was going to say, where were we?
Speaking of writers...
Speaking of two writers...
We can talk about two things at once, which is that, like, you are a writer...
Mm-hmm. You've always been a writer.
Yeah. I definitely do a little bit of the writing there or thereabouts, and I do a lot of the superhero comics writing. So yeah, I kind of two for there. I'm definitely talking about things which connect. Which
yeah,
I do.
And I was gonna say, well, your biggest the Comixology original, The Pride. Mm-hmm. You are the writer of that and creator, right?
Yeah. The Pride started off as a self-published series. So it's literally the first comic book I ever did. And it started off self-published, and we built up an app, and we went to Comixology Submit when Submit became a thing. We were very popular on Submit. We were like in the top 20 or something. 1 year, something like that. Wow. And we were, to my knowledge, and certainly at time of this recording, to my knowledge, we're the only Comixology Submit title that then graduated to a Comixology Originals to do another
season. Amazing.
So,
that's awesome. Yeah.
But essentially what is season one of The Pride and Pride Adventures, that was all self-published. And then season two was Comixology Originals, and then that got collected in an omnibus with Dark Horse, which
with
came
Dark
out,
Horse, yeah.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Pride Month 2021. So yeah, that
congrats.
Was pretty awesome.
I just wanted to bring that up just because it very much fell in line with Generation X in terms of like you picking that topic. So,
Oh yeah, totally. And like Generation X, I would say has a lot of influence and a lot to answer for as far as like the Pride goes. So that the Pride being the series, like, did I actually mention the title of the series when I was talking about it then? So the Pride Omnibus, if you want to go to a comic shop and get it, that is very much comes from this love of Generation X and superhero comics and all of it. And yeah, definitely inspired by a lot of it inspires a lot of the fact that the Pride deals with real issues in a superhero world context. Like, so like we have characters who are HIV positive, we have characters who are like all parts of the LGBTQ spectrum. And like everyone gets a moment to shine, and we get to talk about some of these sort of issues, which often get sort of hand waved as like, oh, it's a gay issue, it's not for me. And it's just like, well, no, it's just, here's this thing, how about you read it and see if you relate to it. And a lot of readers who are straight seem to love it and seem to come to me at Comic Cons and say like about how like, oh, I'd never thought about it this way, and like it's kind of what it's out there for. So yeah, it's nice to know, but it does what I kind of wanted it to do, I guess.
It's always good to hear. Comic-Cons. It's always
And that will segue us into, I guess, the next segment, which is usually we kind of retired this part where we say how we met. But I would like,
for a while.
Yeah, that's true. But, but now it's coincidentally, we have. So I'll let you take this one because I'm going to let Joe take this one.
I know that was
now I got a I got a terrible long-term memory, but I think the first time we actually met, like we might've talked already online on like the Twitters and whatever, but like, I like the way where I sound like an old man when I say about the Twitters.
Twitter. Yeah. It's the S at the end.
Yeah. but I think the first time we actually met was New York Comic Con 2019.
Yeah. That's my memory too. So
yeah, good. I was like, I've literally said to someone before, oh yeah, we met here, and we're going, no, we met about 2 years before that, and I'm like, oh crap, like
we love to put people on blast on this podcast
to challenge your to challenge your impressions and thoughts.
My
we met. Did we? No, we did. Maybe we met at the Vault booth.
Yep. You stopped and then
we went
to
the
Victor's
party in the evening. Yeah. Or rather, you were already there because you were helping with the admissions on the door, making sure the right people are getting inside.
Yes,
the party.
Like exclusive guest list or something.
Yeah. I'm actually doing a disservice. It wasn't the Victor's party; it was the Victor's wake.
Wake, yes.
Yeah,
which was very important. Yeah, and
so Joe, we were in the same room.
You both were in the same room together.
Oh, you there too?
Yes.
Did we meet?
No.
All right. Okay.
No. I would have loved to pull that reveal and be like, Joe, we had a 45-minute conversation. You said you would never forget it. And then
the worst part is from that night, that wouldn't be the first time that's happened.
Oh my God. Like,
I was so hammered at the end of that night.
Oh no, that's fair. No, we did not meet, which I always find the joy of when I like to be like, oh, it's my turn on how we met. And then I just say nothing for a little bit. And then people are like, have we? Because that's fair. It's hard to tell sometimes.
My exact recollection was Joe and I were signing, Joe Carollo, sorry, and I were signing and you walked up to the booth or were already talking to, I think, Adrian. And I was like, I think I know who that is. And and you came over and like introduced yourself and I was like, holy shit, we're, you know, mutuals on Twitter, which doesn't happen very often for me, like meet in real life. It's only happened like 3 times. So
it's bizarre how many times it winds up being the introduction moment for me. Cause like, that's actually how I met Kira and Jamie as well.
Oh, wow.
Because like, it was like Thought Bubble, years before that. So it was before Wicked, it was back from the time we were doing Phonogram, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I went up to their table with a copy of Phonogram Rue Britannia, I think the first volume, to get it signed. And I went up to Kieran and he just goes like, oh, it's Joe. I'm just like,
that's so cool.
Okay, what? Because like we talked on Twitter and stuff. And I'm just like, I don't expect anyone to recognize me off Twitter. Like half the time my user pic isn't even a picture of me, you know? So, but yeah, he recognized who I was. And then like he said, oh, Jamie, it's Joe. And that was how I met Kieran and Jamie and like how our friendship started. So it was just like, oh, right, okay. So I seem to meet people from Twitter a lot. It's also how I met Vita.
That's it. That was my only other circumstance was Vita. And Vita.
So like, because I met Vita at San Diego Comic Con a couple years before 2019. So I want to say it was like 2017.
Oh, I was there they too, were working... I think.
Were you?
Shit. Yeah. Damn.
Because this is back when I was covering comics for Bleeding Cool as well. So like that was when I was like reporting as well as going to Comic Cons as a writer. So I used to wear many hats. Now I don't wear hats because they don't suit my head.
Well, I guess usually we take this moment
four shots.
We're gonna pour another one out for these Gen X kids, these poor babies.
I mean, a lot
poor
of
poor fictional kids. Yeah.
Well, I guess like we've highlighted the pride, but like, are there any projects that you have coming up that you want to talk about and tell our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So, I've actually since doing the pride done quite a lot of other comics and stuff. Most of the stuff I've done has been self-published.
You and me both. You know,
it's just the way to go. Like, I'm one of these guys who's maybe a little bit impatient for comic books sometimes. So sometimes waiting on publishers to actually respond. I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to do it myself. With Kickstarter being how it is at the moment, I don't know how that's going to fare in 2022.
Can't wait to figure that out.
You know, but like, certainly for now. But like, at this point, I've got Glitter Vipers out. I've got a book called Acceptable Losses. Both of them are like one shots and self contained. They're available through my website. And they're on Comixology Kindle as well. Mm-hmm. And then we've now got The Miracles out as well, which was the last big Kickstarter I did, which amazingly only succeeded due to like the love and support of the comics industry, because like we were on that last day and we were not gonna hit target. Like, we were still ages away, and then literally I can't remember who started the ball rolling, but like a bunch of comic creators were out there just be like, let's get this done. And like, next thing I know, we've hit target. And
that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That was awesome. But yeah, the book's finally out. It looks absolutely gorgeous. You know, the artwork by Vince Underwood is just absolutely stunning. Harry Saxon, Hass, and Dan Gruitt, they've all sort of had a part in putting this book together, and it looks absolutely beautiful. And yeah, we should also June 2022 see the anthology Young Men in Love come out, which I'm co-editing with Matt Miner. We're coming out from Wave Blue World with this whole anthology of male/male romances, all written by male or assigned male at birth trans or non-binary creators talking about male/M/M romance and love, because it's so often when you see that kind of thing in fiction media, it's not written by people who really have that experience. Like, it tends to be written by like you know, women writers and things like that, which they do great jobs. Like, Heartstopper is a brilliant book and everything, but like, there's an authenticity which we're going for by having these creators who actually do experience those and have experience living through that particular kind of romance and kind of love.
That's really the key word, authenticity.
So many fantastic creators on that book and so many amazing stories, so I'm really excited for people to finally get to read that. So yeah, that should
also
be,
we love a good Wave Blue World anthology.
Yeah I mean, come on, like, hopefully we'll get nominated for a few awards, like all the other anthologies, because, you know, I was just freaking fantastic too. So let's see.
Hell yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on. It has been a delight. And I know way more about X-Men than I ever thought I would. So
well, I'm happy to come on and watch more
about X-Men. And now I know a couple things about X-Men. So that's how it starts.
Yeah, so you've all got to read Gen X and read these really bizarre stories now.
I'm in it for the weasel, so...
You've got a little while to get to if you start from the beginning, but, like, it's an experience.
To get to that weasel, that's all. I'll drink for that weasel, and that's it.
Comics Inebriated, a podcast about the history of fiction and nonfiction in comics, along with current events, hosted by comic creators Liana Kangas and premier guest Matt Emmons.